Welcome to another Biota podcast. Previously we used to do Biota Lives, and now we seem to be increasingly doing Skype calls, but I have the wonderful pleasure to talk with Steve Grant. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, I've got to offer you a hearty congratulations, but it's an ongoing congratulations because Kickstarter seems to still be going and you still seem to be collecting funds. So for folks listening in who haven't stumbled upon your recent success, can you explain a little bit? Maybe let's take a step back. Let's look at Grandoids as a thing in and of itself. How does it fit into the Steve Grant history of development?
Do I have a history of development?
You have an established history thanks to previous Biota recordings at least. So, but anyway, continue.
Yeah, well, I guess the history goes back 20 years to Creatures. Would you believe it's 19 years since I wrote Creatures, since I started writing it. Anyway, since I finished Creatures 15 years ago, I've been doing research, as you know, and trying to develop new kinds of artificial brain and stuff. And I started writing, well, in fact, I started writing a game which you know about and which we talked about last time on Biota, I think, Symbiosis.
Also known as Symmetry.
That's right. I knew it became something else. I've forgotten what. And then I dropped that. And then I decided, okay, it's time to write another version of Creatures, or rather another Creatures-like game. So I started on that maybe a year ago. And I've been working on it, but things went really slowly. And I've had a bit of a difficult time this last couple of years, divorce and stuff. So I was running out of money. So although I was getting on quite nicely with this game, still in the early stages, but it's going okay. There was no way I could finish it, so I needed some funding. So a friend told me about Kickstarter, and I guess I should explain the principle behind Kickstarter, really, because it was new to me. I'd never come across anything like it before. The idea is with Kickstarter is you put up a project that you want funded, and you assign an amount of time, how long you're willing to take pledges from people, and then people pledge to support your project in return for little rewards, you know, just to make them feel happier, mostly. And the neat thing about it is that if people pledge money and you don't make the amount that you need to make the project work, nobody pays anything to anybody, and so there's no risk involved in putting the project up. You're not going to have to pay enormous fees or something, and you're not going to get in that terrible situation where you get half the money you need, and then you owe these people all that money or the work for it, and you can't actually complete the project. So it's an all or nothing thing. It's really great. So you set a time limit, an amount of money you want to raise, and then people just donate, and you keep your fingers crossed for a while, which is what I did.
And in terms of the tiers, I noticed that you had, I guess somewhat humbly, nominated only $5,000 plus backers, which were eaten up almost instantly. Is this a learning experience for future artificial life folk that go to Kickstarters not to limit the number of $1,000 plus backers? Or can you talk about the tiers and your thinking in terms of actually establishing those tiers?
Mm-hmm. That's quite a complicated business, it turns out. You're supposed to provide these rewards, and if people pledge more than a certain amount, you give them a certain reward. And I think the most common pledge is $35, something like that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of assumed that that's what most people would be pledging me as well, set my middle tiers around that. But, you know, I was optimistic and I thought maybe one or two people would give me more than $35. So I set some higher tiers too. And, you know, more or less as a joke more than anything, I put a $1,000 tier on and said that I'd go and have lunch with whoever gave me $1,000. But I thought I'd better limit the number I was allowed to, that people could pledge, just in case anyone pledged that much. Because, you know, I can't spend the rest of my year traveling around the country having lunch with people. So I set it to five. And they'd gone, those five had gone almost instantly. I was just staggered that I know some of the people who gave me high bids, pledges, but some of them are complete strangers, and it just blows my mind that somebody will just give me $1,000 like that. I'd have had a lot more lunches with people if I'd realised.
Yes, it is. I mean, it is really quite extraordinary. And as a phenomena, I just want to describe the numbers for folks listening in. As of the recording today, you have 26 days to go. I think you originally put the mark at 25,000, is that right?
27,000.
And you're currently at 46,000, with the view that you still have more than half your time allocated to go through. And I think the extraordinary thing about this, I mean, truth be told, when you initially told me about this, I thought this was extraordinarily ambitious, Steve.
So did I.
And I thought this could go a number of different ways. I thought probably 27,000, as you say, was the right amount in terms of it being a... But can you talk a little bit about how this whole thing went viral?
I don't really know how it went viral. I'm quite surprised because I never even got the chance to start on my marketing efforts. I expected to spend the rest of the month writing to people and trying to get people to place articles in blogs and magazines and stuff. And I hardly even got the chance to tell my friends about it because it just went sky high. I mean, I actually made my 27,000 goal in under a week. The curve was just skyrocketing at the time. So I think I told, let's see, I put it on my blog. I told you and, you know, the rest of my Facebook friends. You put it on the mailing list, bio to mailing list. Mm-hmm. I tweeted it, but I don't have that many followers, or at least I didn't. And I told about four or five of the Core Creatures fans. And I think they were
now
probably...
That's the phenomenon. This is the thing that interested me, because certainly my following of your work, particularly, I went back and listened to the 2007, your first three-part Biota interview, because I did a lot of background in that period, and I remember that the Creatures fan base was still very active in terms of the wikis, in terms of... following even minor developers through who had worked on Creatures 2 and what have you into their current life. And there seemed to be a group of, you know, normally hundreds of people that still had an ongoing interest with Creatures, some that had taken it into various open source directions and these kind of things. But this simmering community, I think, was suitably ignited by the thought that you were actually... going to create something that would rival Creatures potentially, and certainly with contemporary hardware, because a lot of the communication through the Creatures wikis is associated with folks actually trying to recreate Creatures in modern software in some regard. And you were offering to do this for, well, what appeared to be through the community, I guess, a relatively small sum. I would like to talk a little bit about how you've kind of optimized your life in the past couple of years in terms of kind of minimizing all possible costs associated with development.
I like the term optimize. I think that's excellent. I'll refer to it as optimizing in the future. Poverty is the word I've been using up to this point. Yes, well, I separated and then divorced, and so I'm living on my own now, so that helps in terms of expenditure. But I stopped eating, basically. I've been living on savings, and so I've been doing okay, but you know, I've been living quite a frugal lifestyle for the last couple of years, waiting for my savings to run out.
Mm. You were talking about a book for a period of time. Obviously this, in the short term, has kind of pushed the book project off, hasn't it?
Yeah, and that's probably a good thing too, because I couldn't get my head around it. I know what I want to write about, but I don't know enough about the subjects yet, and I couldn't get it together. So I kind of wasted the first year of my bachelor life trying to write a book, and it actually wasn't a good idea. I would have done better to write code, because it's sometimes so much easier to explain things to computers. So the book will come back, but I'm quite glad to have a year or two to get away from that and do some coding again. I'm really looking forward to that. It's great.
So returning to this, I mean, obviously this is going to be something that you are creating, but in terms of, I mean, particularly for the Creatures fan base, there are certain things that have kind of followed you through your general software development prior to Creatures, through Creatures, and beyond Creatures. Folks, I guess, are expecting some form of abstract or relatively unique neural network, some kind of analog chemical interactions, and probably a number of other things in this new Grandroids development. Is that the kind of right thinking, or is there something completely new that you're going to be bringing to this development?
It's more of the same, in the sense that Creatures was a bunch of biologically inspired life forms made from neural networks and chemical reactions and genetics, and that was it. That they didn't do anything. There was no plot or objective to the game, and so I'm repeating that this time. But first of all, computers are 1,000 times faster than they were when Creatures was being written. I mean, it started out as a DOS game, for heaven's sake. And also, I've had 15 years to think about it. So my artificial brain ideas have come along a long way. And so I have a very specific design. It's not complete yet, but I have a specific design I want to build into these creatures. And they're quite complex brains. So it's a neural network, but not as we know it, Jim. It's more like a brain than any other neural network I've come across. So that's quite exciting. I have no idea whether it'll work yet.
I guess you have the benefit of the part of the world that you're in. Our first biota conversation, you mentioned going to a mountaintop and staying there for 3 days to develop the creature's brain, and I guess you're surrounded by, similar geographical possibilities where you are currently. So
that's true, and the mountains are so much bigger here as well, which presumably allows for bigger ideas.
Hopefully so. So, in terms, I guess this is based on the amount of money that actually finally ends up coming at the end of now 26 remaining days. But are you going to pace yourself solely on the amount of money that you finally get, or do you have a very fixed time frame in terms of actually developing Grandroids?
It'll be finished when it's finished. But I'm hoping that it will get finished in a year or so, not much longer than a year. But I set the initial funding amount based on how much I could just about survive on for a year. So it was kind of desperation, because there was no point asking for more money than I could get, because if I didn't make my funding goal, then I'd have nothing. And so that would be the end of the project and the end of my life's work, probably. So I set it quite fine. But now I have a good deal more than that. That means I have the luxury of going on a little longer if I want to. More importantly, I can buy development tools and things that I would have had to have managed without before. And also it gives me a bit of leeway between actually releasing the project and product and earning some money from it. So I'm still aiming for about a year, but I have no idea how long it's actually going to take. I think it's a reasonable guesstimate. But the technology involved is really complex, and the neural net stuff is completely untested. Who knows? I could meet up against some really difficult problems, and it will take longer. But I feel reasonably confident about the timing. I wouldn't have dared put this Kickstarter bid in unless I was reasonably confident I could do it in a fair timescale. Because everyone was really excited now, and they're kind of expecting it tomorrow.
Yes, I mean, this was my next question, in fact. It's I don't even know how one could really describe it, but in terms of the more money and the more folk and the more energy that goes towards this Kickstarter goal, the responsibility increases dramatically as well. I mean, obviously there's a sense of amazing euphoria currently, but do you also kind of feel the responsibility that's coming through this thing as well?
Oh yeah, I do. I mean, I'm going to have 400 and something people staring over my shoulder fairly actively as well via the community site and so on. There are going to be tough paymasters in a way, but when you compare it to the alternative, going out and getting business funding, they're a beautiful, wonderful bunch of people to have funding you because they're funding this project because they care about it and they want to see it succeed. They want to get the results, not because they want to make a profit out of me. And so compared to former experiences in the business world, this is delightful. I couldn't wish for a better bunch of backers.
Very true, very true. So as folks are listening in, and particularly there seems to be almost a, not necessarily a jaded quality in the artificial life community, but as folks are listening in, maybe slightly sceptical or maybe considering using Kickstarter for their particular project, what words of advice would you give them?
Well, go for it. I mean, I'm not usually very positive about things. I tend to assume it's all going to go horribly wrong. And I more or less assumed this was going to go horribly wrong, and I was steeling myself for it. And then I just couldn't believe what was going on, the way the money was coming in. People actually did care about this stuff. So it's a big world out there, and it's surprising. Once you can connect to that world, how many people there are who want to see something happen, who will donate quite large sums of money for it. So go for it. It's quite an interesting business actually setting out the project. I mean, you have to make a video for a start, and I'm not a great self-marketer, but I had quite a lot of fun making the video. It took me ages, but getting the video right I think is quite important, and then getting these reward tiers right. I mean, I kind of got that wrong, but I don't mind that I got it wrong. I don't think I got it wrong in principle. It's just that people were much more generous than I expected. But there's statistics available on the Kickstarter side about what the median and mean donations are. And I think there are a few people who have put out blogs with their reflections on their own projects and how it went and what they did to market it and so on. That was kind of frightening, actually. I read a couple of these at the beginning and just about when I was ready to launch, and I thought, oh my God, I haven't done anything like that. I haven't gone to all that trouble. I haven't lined up all these articles in important magazines and stuff. And so I thought it was going to be a terrible disaster. But you can gain some inspiration from looking at these examples and finding out how people have approached the problem. It's quite hard. I mean, I put this in the games section, and it's kind of a game, but only kind of a game. And I couldn't quite figure out where to place it. Most of the projects on Kickstarter are theatrical and artistic and literary. And the games section tends to have the kind of thing you might expect to have in the game section, quite middle of the road, first person shoot 'em up type games. And so I thought, this might actually get lost there because it's, partly a game, partly science, partly education, partly something I don't know quite what. But it didn't seem to matter in the end. I mean, most of the people I think came at it from outside of the Kickstarter site. They came to my URL directly, rather than going through the front page of Kickstarter. Getting some coverage is really important. I mean, I didn't try with the marketing, but I just got, somebody asked me if they could write a short article on it for Mashable. And so, sure, I did an interview for Mashable, and as soon as that came out, there was a huge blip in pledges. And then one of the creatures guys, or a few people actually, tried to get it onto Slashdot, and one of them succeeded in getting it on Slashdot, and wham, the pledges just started rolling, and then the curve went almost vertical. So getting in touch with the world's nerds and geeks is pretty critical, it seems.
Now, the one element that you haven't talked about is the length of time. And that, I think, is an interesting thing with Kickstarter. And certainly when I initially saw that you'd launched it, I wanted to get you on this this Biota podcast as soon as possible to get the word out to the faithful. How do you think the length of time is important? And would you just recommend to folk to... I think you were on for 40 days. That was
the length of time. Yeah, 6 weeks, yeah. It's a funny thing, the time. I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed now that I still have all this length of time to go. Kickstarter actually recommends 30 days. But that seems a bit short to me. I thought, well, I hardly know anybody. I'm not going to be able to get it out there. It's going to take me at least a week just to write all the emails to people and say, hey, look at my project. And then they're going to think about it for a week or two. And so I need to give myself a bit longer than a month. But Kickstarter says the internet is a fast place, and they're right. I mean, you know, I could have stopped. I could have given it a week, and I still would have got funded. So it seems like short is quite good. When you look at the stats from other people's projects, there tends to be a sudden burst of funding right at the beginning, as you'd expect, and then it drops off. And then there's another burst in the last few days as everyone starts to get desperate to reach their goal. No, I haven't got to the last few days yet, but I can't imagine there'll be another burst. I think the curve's pretty flat now, and I'm happy to leave it at that. But it rocketed up in the first few days, almost a straight line, until well past my funding goal. So I think if I did it again, I'd do it for a shorter period. It's just that it takes nerve to do that, because if you fail, there's no going back. You know, you've lost that, and you kind of lost face with it. It'd be hard to put up another project immediately afterwards. So I gave myself plenty of time, but in the event, it was way too much time.
And, I mean, what you seem to be describing in terms of the way other folk use Kickstarter is that they basically have all their ducks lined up with regards to publicity and these kind of things, which I guess in anticipation would probably mean a shorter Kickstarter period would make more sense, particularly if they're anticipating a kind of last-minute push. But for the artificial life community, do you think... I mean, obviously, if people are serious about this, they may go that route and have the media lined up early on and these kind of things. How long can a Kickstarter period be? Can it go for, you know, 2-3 months, or are you actually limited?
I think there's a limit of 90 days, so 3 months. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that that's the limit. And I think if you haven't got funded after 3 months, then you're probably never going to get funded, because these things tend to have a momentum to them. Like I say, my curve has flattened off now, and I'm quite content with that. I've kind of got an embarrassment of riches now, and I'm not going to put any more effort into trying to drum up support, because I've got more than I wanted anyway. So I'm happy that it's flattened off after 2 weeks. But if it flattened off at, say, $10,000 after 2 weeks, then the chances are is you'd get a little burst at the end, and you probably wouldn't make it. So it doesn't seem like it would pay to put a very long period on it. It's a bit hard to tell, because I'm not necessarily a representative example. I mean, because of the Greatest community, you know, one person knows 10 people, those 10 people know 10 people, and before you know it, it's viral, and the news has got out. So I was lucky that I had creatures behind me and this whole bunch of people, many of whom now have children of their own and would love their children to play with something like creatures. So I didn't need to do much in the way of marketing, as it turned out. I mean, I expected to. I thought I'd have to struggle. But news got out. So now whether that would work in general in the A-Life community, I don't know. I happen to have a bestseller game behind me.
what I found was particularly interesting, I mean, I think it's probably in the 97 context, but also with regards to Symmetry, is that, and maybe it's a luxury that I have with you in particular, Steve, but I found that the Creatures community, the wikis and what have you, really weren't following your current work. I mean, there were certain things, but I was posting, for example, when you first came on Biota in 2007, immediately there was a kind of spike in the wikis and they filled in some of the gaps. But things like your Wikipedia entry and the information on the wikis wasn't very current at the time that I surveyed it, and certainly with Symmetry as well. Do you get the sense now that the Creatures community is tuned into exactly what you're doing? Was there some benefit in this as well in terms of just reinvigorating and reconnecting you with the Creatures community?
Oh, yes, I think so. Yeah, I mean, that sort of being hidden from view thing goes back right to the beginning of Creatures itself, really, because though I wrote most of the game myself, by the time it was launched, I was the director of the company, and so I had to be all corporate and kind of not be seen, if you see what I mean. I couldn't, you know, because it was clearly my game, I could have been a personality, and that would have detracted from what the rest of the company was trying to do. So I had to kind of hide somewhat and didn't get the chance to take part in the Creatures community. So I kind of gained a mythical status quite early on. But I wasn't terribly well connected with these people. And then in more recent years, you know, my work has been more or less hidden from view in the last 5 to 10 years. So, yeah, you're right. They didn't follow that. But obviously they remembered. And as soon as they started to realize that there's a new game coming out, they got all excited again. So now I have 421 backers at the moment. About 350 of those are going to be beta testers or advanced beta testers. So I've got not only a whole bunch of excited people who have ideas and lots to talk about, but I also have all the testers I need. So they're pretty valuable in themselves, never mind the donations they make. It's going to be so much easier to make the game work with those people there. So that's a really good thing. It's a thing that Kickstarter clearly does for people that I hadn't even thought of when I took the project up. So it does actually generate a community of interest and connects you with people.
Very good, very good. So I have a series of kind of technical development questions, but it sounds like you're still very early days associated with what this thing will finally look like and what form it will take. But in terms of actually releasing a game currently, I mean, obviously we live in the age of, you know, the iPad, iPod, what have you, single source sales point for games and wide variety of other things. So I guess the model has changed quite rapidly in the past 5 years. But is this going to be something that you will release for online distribution for a set amount of money when it finally comes out? Or is there going to be a phase in? Obviously, you have beta testers waiting in the wings currently. Well, what's your will it be box software? I mean, I think box software is pretty well dead. I mean, what's your view in terms of how you're actually going to get this thing out?
I honestly don't know, Tom. I don't know what the business model should be yet. And I think it'll emerge, you know, nearer the end of the project, it'll become apparent what's the best way to do this. I mean, it may be best to give the game away and earn some money from add-ons and objects and things. It's hard to say, and I don't know what price point or anything yet. Because of the way our work starts with the biology, I think it's important for me personally to create the creatures and find out what they want to do. Until I know what the creatures are capable of, what their personalities are like, what their physics is like, how much computer resources they need, it's kind of hard to work out what the final packaged product is going to look like and how best to distribute it. But the chances are it will be like a box product, but a download, relatively modestly priced and hopefully sold virally. I don't exactly have a marketing department. But it's very hard to tell yet. I'm going to release, it'll be released for Mac and PC and probably Linux if Unity get their act together in time. And then I can go on to iPhone and Android and so on. So I'm not sure that there's going to be one big release day. It'll come out in dribs and drabs. But I just don't know yet. You'll have to ask me in a year.
Certainly. So in terms of, going back to Creatures, you did almost all of Creatures, and I think the artistic side was the only thing that got scrubbed up by other folk in the original Creatures. Is that right?
That and the user interface. I actually wrote the whole thing, and a lot of the user interface. There were these tools, these kits, and things that you could connect to the core program via Olay in those days. Mm-hmm. And I wrote those in Visual Basic because it was a nice, quick, and easy language for knocking up GUI-rich software. But my company didn't like the thought that it was in Visual Basic because that was kind of cheap and unprofessional. So then there was a team of people came in and rewrote all that into C++. So it was mostly user interface and graphics that were done as a team. And then the core A-Life stuff I did.
So in terms of Grandroids, are you making a commitment through the Kickstarter, the way that you framed this whole thing through the Kickstarter release, that this will be solely your development, or do you foresee that it may get to the point where, it could be, picked up by EA or these kind of things and scrubbed up? Do you get a sense of that? Are you making a commitment that it will just be your work, or do you get a sense that there may come a time where it could get, filtered into one of these other larger enterprises?
No, I don't really want to go through a publisher. I think they'd scrub it up for sure, but they'd also screw it up. Mm. I think. I don't think games publishers understand these things. I was lucky with Creatures, mostly because it kind of made a personal impact on the CEO of the company, and so he became very committed to it and dropped everything to make it work. But if I went to EA, I don't think I would get that kind of attitude from them, and they would focus group it and market it and put 40 people on it and make it look beautiful, but they wouldn't be interested in the A-Life, they wouldn't be interested in the science, and they wouldn't be interested in most of the things that I think the people who are actually going to like this game are interested in. It's been nice. One of the many nice things about this Kickstarter project has been all these people writing comments on the site saying, hey, thank goodness you're going to do this again. I've been waiting for this for years. And did you know you put me into a biological career or made me take up computer science or whatever. So it's pretty clear from the people who've pledged that they want this because they care about the technical aspects, the A-Life aspects, not because they want some cute pets to play with. And I think that would all be lost if it went through a publisher. I almost lost it with Creatures because that was going to be published by Maxis. And Maxis would have been the one company on Earth because of SimCity, and they were working on what was called Doll's House at the time that became The Sims. And they would have been the one company on Earth that could actually have understood this, and they did. Jeff Braun, who was CEO of Maxis, understood it, and he was keen. But then there was some kind of internal coup inside Maxis, and it became much more commercialized, and they didn't understand the game at all, and we just couldn't see eye to eye on it, and eventually they just dropped us. And it's probably a good thing. So I'm not thrilled by the kind of connection between A-Life and the standard, mainstream games companies. I don't think this kind of stuff works very well with them. So yeah, my plan is to do it single-handed until it's released, and then of course there'll be well, in fact, during the development process, there'll be people writing tools for it and that kind of stuff. I just want to keep control of the actual biology, because that requires a unified vision. You know, and I already know what it is I want to do there. So I'm writing the core, and then other people hopefully take it and run with it and write tools and objects and so on. So it'll be a community effort in the end.
So you've moved perfectly into my next question, which relates to tools and a relatively open API, because it seems like you are interested in, I guess, some part of the games community in terms of exactly as you're describing, the tools and the API and mod authors. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, you've talked about the biological core remaining your own, but do you anticipate that there will be reskinned versions and things taken in completely different directions? How constrictive is the API going to be? And more importantly, do you get a sense that this could become something that was almost a development toolkit that could actually be picked up by both independent and also potentially commercial games?
Yes. I mean, there's quite a tricky balance to play out. I want to make the API as flexible as I possibly can without making it so flexible that it inhibits the coherence of the product and the gameplay and the efficiency of the code and so on. So it's kind of a tricky balance. There's actually two APIs, which is unusual. There's a standard code API, but the genetics is also an API in the sense that people will be able to create new species and so on by plugging together genes differently. So there's a kind of biology API and a code API. But I'm going to make it as open and flexible as I can, but I'm going to do it through the API rather than making it open source, because the complexity of the biology is pretty advanced stuff, and I don't think it would help if that was exposed. I prefer the brains and stuff to be exposed through genetics than exposed through an API. But I'll make it as open as I can. You know, and certainly I expect, again, there's a kind of tricky balance, because I want people to be able to build new worlds for it, new creatures, new objects to put in the world and make it as open and fluid as possible. But I also need to make a living out of it, because this is going to fund my future research. So I'm not quite sure how to do that for best yet.
Yes, I was going to avoid the open source issue, but as you raised it, I mean, certainly when I first posted, and there was an interesting, as you noted, there was an interesting kind of candor to the posts associated with will it be open source, because I think in large part the folks that wanted it to be open source were just really interested in getting involved personally. And I think that's always certainly my experience with Noble Ape, and Noble Ape has been open source since it first started, and in terms of the complexity of the cognitive simulation, the biology and these kind of things, and also recently our mutual friend Bob Bottram's contribution in terms of the social graphing, I don't want to disagree with you, but I don't think that having complex biology or cognitive simulations or what have you out in open source means that people, in fact, the reverse is true. Oftentimes the complexity can actually stop people from tinkering with it directly. although Intel's contribution with Noble Ape has been phenomenal in terms of just repurposing the complexity to particularly esoteric processes. But I guess my question is, the connection that you have with regards to making money versus things being open source, I mean, you seem to almost be completely embracing the open source model in terms of the APIs. Is it just that you have particular kind of passionate interests associated with certain parts of this, and other parts you're willing to skin in your own way, but you kind of acknowledge perhaps, as you describe with creatures, the ability for others to have, in the case of the user interface, in the case of graphic design elements? Are you just identifying really your own particular points of passion as things that you want to be very directly and almost... do you anticipate, as with creatures, that you'll be publishing academic papers on the closed aspects?
Yeah, I mean, when I say closed, I certainly don't mean hidden. It's not proprietary in the sense of trade secrets. I should be publishing papers and things. It's more that, yes, I am passionate. The part I'm passionate about is the artificial intelligence side. And I have very strong ideas about how to do that and what will work and what won't. And I kind of don't want that to get diluted. And it kind of happened in Creatures. I mean, I hope none of my former colleagues are listening to this, but yeah, I wrote Creatures 1 and then I got kicked upstairs to the boardroom, and so I didn't have much involvement with Creatures 2 and almost zero involvement in Creatures 3. But they were all based on the same engine. They were 90-odd% the same code. But they kind of added bits to the biology, and they didn't do it the way I would have done it, let's say. They kind of tacked bits on instead of coming up with elegant solutions. And it developed in that sort of, you won't like this, but in that open sourcey way that tends to happen. You have thousands of bits stuck together, none of which talk to each other terribly well.
Again, that hasn't necessarily... I mean, look, open source in terms of downloading and requiring exactly the same kind of, esoteric Perl and Python hacks in order to get it compiled and all this kind of stuff is not the kind of open source that I'm advocating here at all. And as you've described as well, the complexity, black box nature of certain aspects of open source is also... I think there's the what you're describing in terms of nurturing interaction, however, what you missed from your description of being in the boardroom versus being, I guess, a development lead, is something that I think is central to the kind of open source that I have embraced in terms of always being the, not necessarily always being the development lead, but knowing when I can pass it to people such as Bob Mottram or the folks at Apple or Intel, but then come back and give critical analysis and review. And I think really open source is what you make of it. It's not something which, and I've fought against a lot of the nonsense that you're describing. And the beauty of open source really is that you can tailor your particular flavor associated with your particular project. Again, somewhat relating to the complexity problem that, people that tinker with it may break it very early on. So there is some benefit in underlying complexity. But I guess there seems to be so many elements in your development that are what I would think are fundamentally open source that maybe there needs to be some, I guess, clearly you've had some bad experiences or heard some bad stuff in the past, but I want to say that this isn't, I've seen these things happen as well, but with open source that I have experienced, a number of other folks in the artificial life community, the reverse is true on almost all the examples that you've provided.
I'm not knocking open source at all. All I'm saying is it's not for me.
This is curious because I think for everything that you're saying, large parts of it seem to be for you. You just have various kind of curious... in fact, this is the audio that was cut from the 2007 pilot. This got particularly heated for folks listening. Not necessarily heated, but we weren't really going anywhere, and it doesn't really feel like we're going anywhere currently. So perhaps moving on from this topic of discussion.
Let me just say, though, that I don't see myself as a programmer. I'm a scientist. Mm-hmm. I'm a researcher. I'm an inventor. And that's what I do. What I do is invent new things, new ways of dealing with problems in artificial intelligence, and I don't think that is a thing which works well when it's parceled out between people. It doesn't in academia. Collaboration doesn't make that work. It leads to Japanese robots.
But how does the whole notion of the PhD process? I mean, that I look at it more like the PhD process, which is fundamentally collaboration. It's collaboration both critically and almost paternalistically in terms of actually... And I think what you're describing here is some very curious example of collaboration, but certainly within academia, almost to the point where it's Masonic, there is continuous collaboration, perhaps more than is healthy. So I would say that... what you're describing here doesn't necessarily gel with my own views, and particularly in its context, but... perhaps we should move on. I'm not sure.
All right.
It kind of digresses. So again, this is another thing that digresses rapidly in our conversation, but I'll throw it out there anyway. When I talked to you in 2007, you were quite firm in the view that what you had done, perhaps in the decade prior, was not artificial life. But in launching Grandroids, you very much are embracing artificial life again, perhaps as a term. How has your relationship with the term changed in the past 4 years?
Well, I don't think my relationship with it has changed. I think it's maybe changed, or maybe there's it's just coloured in a slightly different light. I don't see myself as an artificial life researcher. I borrow Larry Yeager's term. He describes himself as somebody who's interested in an artificial life approach to artificial intelligence. And I think that's what I do too. So I'm primarily interested in intelligence, not life. And so I sometimes try to distance myself from A life a little, because in practice, most A life is evolutionary. And although my creatures are genetically programmed, evolution isn't the point. So I've had trouble in the past trying to explain these fine distinctions. That yes, I meet creatures that can evolve, but no, they're not going to, because they're nowhere near simple enough to evolve in the amount of time that you will be patient enough to watch. My interest is in neuroscience. My interest is in how brains work. So I'm kind of stuck. I mean, I do take an artificial life approach. I'm very bottom up. I approve of everything that's being done in A-Life, or most of it. But what I try to produce is artificial intelligence. So that's the focus. But on the other hand, I have very little in common with what's going on in the AI world. So I'm kind of fall between the two stools. So it's difficult. But the short answer is I take an A-Life approach to AI. And I've been fairly consistent about that for the last 30 years, I think. And if anything's changed, it's probably A-Life.
So that's my next question. Do you think it's the public perception of artificial life that has changed in the past 4 years?
I'm not sure whether there is a public perception of artificial life, is there?
Well, this is, again, my next question. You seem to have read my questions in advance. So just prior to us getting together, Bruce Dame afforded me the great debate, What is Life?, which was actually recorded in Tempe, Arizona, February 12th. And Dawkins and Ventner and a few other folk were at it. And what was curious is in the beginning of the talk, they actually talked a bit about artificial life. In fact, this was Bruce Dahmer's email heading was, you know, you must watch this. They talk about artificial life. And they start with Langton. They get to Tom Ray. And then they completely drop off. And I know you've recently written an encyclopedic definition of artificial life. How do you think... I mean, maybe, I guess you consider yourself part of the artificial life community by default, but you're not part of the artificial intelligence community to take an artificial life approach. Let's work you into that.
All right.
How do you think we change the conversation to actually talk about what is currently going on with artificial life, and perhaps not necessarily add a few names after Tom Ray, but at least get popular intellectuals that do occasionally talk on science to larger groups to actually have a more coherent view of what artificial life is?
That's a very good question. I think it'll be easier when we all have a coherent view of what artificial life is. And I think at the moment we have perhaps a less coherent view than we had when it all started in 1986-ish. I mean, Richard Dawkins, you say he was talking about it with Craig Venter. Richard was at the first A-Life conference. That Chris Langton called in 1986 or 7. So he's been there right from the beginning.
But yet in the God Delusion, he references the Biota conference without actually naming it explicitly, without saying, I think it's an artificial life conference. And maybe actually you and I were both involved with the reason that Biota was actually scrubbed from that, but that might be for another time. In terms of that context, I mean, certainly I was at Bruce Damer's a month ago, and he pulled out the God Delusion, and he said, not only does he not mention Biota, he also gets the year wrong. How do we, obviously there have been these points in time where artificial life has changed particular thinkers' perspectives, but if they're not actually going to talk about it now for their current audience, and this is something that the Wikipedia folk, I had some to-ing and fro-ing about Dawkins' impact on artificial life, because his entry has nothing about his interest in artificial life or his impact on artificial life, Blind Watchmaker et al. So how, in terms of this notion of the history of artificial life and what it is coherently, and the folk that have been, you know, impacted on early stages but no longer talk about it in a public way, how do we resolve all of this?
Well, maybe we wait. I don't know. I think I was going to suggest that Richard Dawkins and Craig Venter kind of act as bookends to the history of artificial life, because Richard was interested right back in the beginning when Chris Langton was, you know, he coined the phrase and called the first conference, and so he was kind of behind it all. And in those days, artificial life was most definitely the study of life in principle, rather than life in practice, and that's distinct from life in practice. And that's the kind of a life that I generally subscribe to. But then if you look at Craig Venter, he's making artificial cells. And so that's artificial life too, but it's very definitely life as it is, or at least life within the constraints of life as it is. You know, it's real biology, it's actual cells made from proteins and deoxyribonucleic acid, not some DNA-like concept or substance or anything. So you've got both extremes of A-life there. You've got the life in principle, Langton side of things, and you've got the synthetic life, the wet A-life, explicit biological side that's coming in. Now, I've seen that trend happening for several years now. You know, when I referee conference papers, the number of wet A-life papers has been going up steadily, and the number of wet A-life themes in the conference call for papers has been going up steadily. So it seems to me like in academia, A-life has been making a transition from the spirit of life to the practice of life,
just a term change, though. I mean, what has happened in terms of what was previously called soft and hard artificial life is they have bridged into a wide variety of different terms as well, in terms of probably conferences that are on offer, depending on what you want to call either of those previously, you know, defined groups. They have expanded in terms as well, and in wide variety of conferences, a wide variety of different directions, and so many distinctions in between that, you know, I'm hesitant to even start giving the names. But do you think that that is actually the case, and what has happened? I mean, I think particularly with Mark Badeau's influence and Sten Rasmussen and all these folk, they have really moved on to wet artificial life and maintained that term. And I think what's particularly curious with Ventner is that there was probably a couple of years ago, he was making a very heavy rebranding effort associated with what artificial life was, which was even very different from wet artificial life. And it was all getting very curious. And I had an interesting discussion with Mark Badeau on this very beta podcast associated with that. So do you think that it's just the fact that the plurality of things that are artificial life now have all their kind of sub-disciplines and expanding terms, and it's not necessarily that all the interesting artificial life stuff is moving to wet artificial life?
I think I'd say that the plurality has been the problem of artificial life throughout its history. There were a bunch of people with their own personal agendas who found that there was some, you know, A cap B was a reasonable set that they could, there was some overlap between what they were interested in, and so artificial life got founded as a discipline, but it was never a coherent discipline because these individuals had their own agendas.
Of course.
But equally, I don't think it's just a matter of semantics. I think there, maybe Dawkins, I mean, Richard's not a great example, perhaps, but if you take him as an example of the Chris Langton crew, then him and Craig Venter do mark extremes in those personal agendas. You know, when Craig Venter's lab finally produces a cell, we'll know how to make a cell. And that's a brilliant achievement and a major step forward for science, but it's not artificial life. It's life that's artificial, but it doesn't tell us anything about the principles of life. It only tells us what the minimal components are for life based on exactly the same toolkit that biological life is based on. It won't even tell us what life on Mars might be like, or Titan or wherever. So although it's going to tell us a lot of biology, it's not going to tell us much about the philosophical basis of life. And I think that's what was very strong in the early years of artificial life and has dropped off somewhat, almost inevitably.
Analysis. I know you've been a part of some of these origins of books, and I certainly think that what Gordon Sekbak et al. are doing in terms of this is, in some regard, perhaps refocusing aspects of the artificial life community to the potential for us to have something to say about the origins of something, whether or not it's life, it might be something else. But I think this is... I think there's something that's distinctly philosophically sticky about artificial life, which continues irrespective of the various directions that it seems to be going. And it is really quite curious that maybe as the term changes and evolves, that as you've described, this philosophy is something which almost, you know, maintains the field in some kind of abstract definitional form, nothing else.
Well, I hope that's true. I mean, it's pretty much inevitable this kind of thing happens in an early field, and particularly a highly holistic field like artificial life. I think if you look at the history of cybernetics, it's quite a good parallel. I mean, cybernetics started out in much the same way. There were artists and scientists and computer people and mathematicians who had their own agendas, but they saw the world in a non-standard way. And they suddenly met each other and realized that they shared some of that non-standard way. And so cybernetics was born, and it was originally a very philosophical discipline, and quite holistic and even quite spiritual in its leanings. And, you know, embraced art and science equally, which is true for artificial life too. You know, people like Steve Rook and so on. There's been a lot of A-life art. So in that sense, they were very similar disciplines. Well, if you look at what happened to cybernetics, because it was wishy-washy and philosophical and a way of looking at things, and because most of the world didn't look at things in that way and couldn't really get their spirits behind what the early cyberneticists were saying, they tended to look at the practicalities of it rather than the philosophy. And then they kind of reified it. They hardened it off, and information was born. You know, information theory grew out of cybernetics, but it's not really what cybernetics was about. Mm. And it took over. Information theory took over from cybernetics. A lot of the things that had coalesced to make cybernetics start out got reabsorbed back into their original disciplines, back into the arts and mathematics and so on. And what we were left with was information theory and telecommunications, and which in many respects is the philosophical opposite of cybernetics. And I think that's probably happened in artificial life too, that it started out with these people who saw the world in a different way, and they realized that they'd met other people who saw the world in a different way too, and they all got together, and it was very spiritual and holistic and philosophical and stuff. But then you have to run PhD courses, and you have to teach this stuff. And the second generation of people tends to learn it more by the book than having been born into the spirit of it.
Mm.
So it tends to become hardened, and it becomes dogma.
That's interesting, because I take a different view. My view is that cybernetics to information theory is to do with financial things. That basically there's no direct source of funding for cybernetics, and information theory immediately has a variety of different sources of funding. And this is, I think, where the metaphor breaks down with artificial life, perhaps. Maybe there are sources of funding.
No sources of funding and no practical point.
Exactly. So maybe we've immune ourselves from this trap by our own impracticality. So
yeah, well, that may well be true. I mean, I think you're right. That's true. I don't think it's the whole of it. Mm. I think there were philosophical things. I think there were schisms and there was schisms, do you say, in this country? There were fights going on in cybernetics, and the old world reabsorbed this new world that could have become something better, and it got wiped out. And it almost happened to artificial life, but maybe in a way, you know, wet artificial life is the savior of it, because it's immediately obvious what the practical benefits are, and there's funding there, huge amounts of funding. So I think we're probably both right about cybernetics, and we may both be right about artificial life too.
I don't think we disagree about artificial life, but anyway.
But yeah, there's a spiritual journey and like you say, a funding journey and a practicality journey.
So completely tongue-in-cheek, the one question of the Mashable piece that I found kind of harked back to an older Steve Grant was, what other artificial life / intelligence projects are you keeping tabs on? What should we be excited about? Do you have any kind of thoughts on that as a question, in the context of what we've been talking about how we actually change the narrative associated with artificial life?
Well, my answer in the interview was that I'm the wrong person to ask, and to a large extent I said that because otherwise what could I say? I couldn't, you know, pick one person's project and say this is brilliant.
Yeah.
Because everyone else would be upset, you know. but it's also true. I mean, I don't pay much attention. You know, if I get invited to speak somewhere, then I'll pay a lot of interest and attention to what people are doing in the place where I've gone to speak, and then I'll forget about it because I don't have a very good memory for these things. And you know, because I'm a hobbyist, I just plow my own furrow. I don't really want to watch what other people are doing. So I'm not well placed to judge these things. I referee papers when I'm asked to, but I don't keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on in the AI world very much.
It's interesting because you did reference the community. I mean, that's what I found interesting about your response. Certainly, Steve Grand circa the middle of last decade may not have referenced a community. this version at least referenced that there was a community of a kind of heavy competition. I think I should have actually what you said directly in front of me as well. But also the question about claims that are made in artificial life. Is this something that you feel is a current problem, that people make too many claims or perhaps too similar claims associated with their particular project?
In artificial life, I don't think so. I mean, I'm not sure if anyone's making any claims, particularly in pure A life. You know, they just do what they want to do, and people like it or they don't like it. But AI is terrible for claims.
Certainly.
The amount of hype in AI is dreadful. And it's, you know, it's always misplaced. So one of the reasons I try not to talk about other people's projects in newspapers and so on is I'll only end up slagging them off. I'll only end up being rude about them because there is always this gap between, and maybe it's true for my project too, I really don't know, but you know, there's always this huge gap between people's expectations and what actually gets delivered. And AI is it's very easy to act in AI. It's very easy to make something that really looks impressive and then fails to deliver. And there's still just as much of that going on today as there was 30 years ago. It's just that it's mostly in robotics these days. So you know, public perception and reality just almost have nothing, no connection with each other as far as I can see.
It is interesting because certainly in terms of the recording, in large part it's been to do with the level of contact as well. I think the artificial life community has changed in the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that the folks that are getting in contact, I contacted you, but Dave Kerr will be coming up in the near future, have found new ways of framing artificial life into either particular products or particular projects that are very much about making a little bit of money. And I think this is an interesting perhaps change in the community that some of us have just gone underground and started writing feverishly and writing code feverishly, and others are looking at really translating what has been their life's passion into something that will make money. In the current economy, it is a very interesting thing that, you know, if you can survive in this economy doing what you love, then potentially when things pick up, and you've made reference to, and I didn't want a question too heavily associated with your living conditions currently, but you made a very definite view associated with moving to the US, associated with particularly perceptions that you had of Silicon Valley and these kind of ideas. Is it still your dream to live in that part of the US and feed off the potential intellectual insight funding et al? Or are you really enjoying the the hermit nature of your current existence in the US? Yeah. I'm interested in this kind of translation in terms of your vision for the future, where you are currently and where you kind of think you'll be, this kind of stuff.
I like the hermit life. I definitely enjoy it. I love where I live now, and it's lovely having mountains and deserts just outside the door. I wish I was a little closer to Silicon Valley because I really like the people there, or at least I really like the geeks there. Not so keen on the businessmen.
Mm.
So Silicon Valley's you know what it's like.
Oh,
it's very high pressure, very hyped up place. It's exhausting to be there from on the day. I love talking to the people because they're all so bright and intelligent and interesting and excitable. That's great, but then I like to get away again. I don't think I could live in that environment. And certainly I have no plans to go back to the dot-com world, venture capital and all that kind of nightmare. So my ambition is to be able to afford to live in my little hermitage reasonably comfortably and have the luxury of carrying on doing what I'm really passionate about. And like you say, if you can do that in this climate, that's a miracle. If you can do it in any climate, it's a miracle. What more could anyone want than the opportunity to fulfill their passions and ideally get paid for it?
It's interesting because SRI, and it's funny because I was back in the Bay Area about a month ago. And I had actually luxury time in the Bay Area, which is a rarity for me. I was traveling around with my brother. It was his first time in the US, and I thought, you know, this would be wonderful. So we spent a week traveling around, and I spent a couple of days in Berkeley. And I really feel very much more akin to Berkeley than I do to the Stanford area. But what Stanford Research has done perfectly, offered a place for folks such as yourself to give occasional guest lectures. And do you foresee the potential in the future for you to go periodically to Silicon Valley and other areas and give inspirational talks and then feed off some of that energy as you return to your hermitage?
Yeah, that's a very nice way to live a life, I think, yeah. You go and stand up in front of people, talk for a bit, and then basically going and giving a lecture is just a way of introducing yourself, I think. And then you get the pleasure of everyone's company for a while, and then you can leave them and go back to the peace and quiet of home. So that's kind of the life I've lived until relatively recently anyway. You know, I quite often get asked to give talks, and though I haven't done it for a while, they're starting to happen again now. And it's yeah, that's a lovely a lovely kind of environment. Go on, talk about your stuff, get excited, meet all these people, and have fun, learn stuff, and then go home and go back to some peace and quiet. I like that. So as soon as SRI invites me to give a lecture, I shall be along.
Yeah, my anticipation is as soon as this podcast goes out, you should get an invitation. In fact, it's rather curious that you haven't gotten an invitation so far, because I think certainly, yeah, I mean, I've given an SRI, and mine was very poorly attended. It was quality rather than quantity in terms of the folk that were there, but just exactly the right group of folk there. So, yeah, I think, and also the other thing about the SRI talks is, because the Artificial Life ones, I typically put the recordings out in podcast form. A number of the folks who lived in the Bay Area who'd said, oh, yes, we'll come and see you when you're at SRI, had either colds or, you know, family in town or whatever. And I said, oh, yeah, no, we'll just listen to the audio when it comes out.
Yeah, that's the way it is these days.
Nobody
needs to be physically there anymore.
Exactly. So, Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And it's also interesting because we're in relatively close physical proximity. I don't know if you have any anticipation of heading to Southern California again, and whether you'd come through Vegas or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I'll try to. I do plan a tour around California because there's a whole bunch of people I need to see.
Mm.
And it's only a slight diversion to come via Vegas, so I'll come and see you. That'd be nice.
Yeah. Well, we have a guest bedroom and a large library, and if you're not allergic to cats, there shouldn't be any problem, really.
I love cats.
Wonderful. We are the house for you, then. We are the house for you. Well, Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure. And what I'd like to do is periodically have you on a Biota podcast just to get updates and directions, and mainly also because I think this thing is still very fluid, isn't it?
Extremely, yeah. It's going to crystallize in front of my eyes, and I'll find out what it's become. Yeah, I'm not in charge of this project. These creatures are in charge of themselves, so I'm just there to discover what happened.
Ah, very interesting. So yeah, we'll need to find some maybe equal, maybe non-equal period of time to get you back on. Maybe as you have various breakthroughs or various things crystallize, and certainly as you go through the beta cycle. If there are particular beta testers that you'd like to have on, because certainly users and these kind of perspectives are always good to inject into the Biota discussion as well. So please consider that.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent idea. Having some other people on would be great. Yeah, sure. Well, I'm back in the business now. It seems I'm funded. I have to do this.
Yeah.
So it's my job at last.
Yeah. Well, with 26 days to go and with the anticipation that I should get the audio out in the next couple of days, it's very easy to actually find literally Steve Grand Kickstarter in Google will get you the page instantly. So
that'll get me there. Yeah, or Grand Droids. Yeah,
yes, exactly. So folks listening in have the option to kick you a bit of cash.
So if I don't see a blip in the funding, then I'll blame you.
Yes. Well, in terms of the lunches, if people contribute more than $1,000, would you still be willing to humour a lunch with them?
Yeah, I would humour it as long as I can get to them, as long as they live somewhere I can actually get to. This is a huge country, as you know. So,
yes.
Yeah. Luckily, nobody in Alaska pledged $1,000.
Do you still have Amtrak that goes through where you are?
Yeah, we do. Yes, right through the middle of Flagstaff. Good old railway town it is.
Las Vegas lost their Amtrak in 97. Otherwise, I would see a lot more of the U.S. flying is the major pain about this country. But anyway.
I haven't actually been on the train here. I'd love to do that.
No, Amtrak is wonderful. I went from the Bay Area back to Reno to get a flight back here. And in fact, when I arrived in the U.S. in 99... I'd flown for about 3.5 months solid, and most of the flights that I'd had in the US were either heavily delayed, I had my luggage stolen in Philadelphia, and I promised myself that I wouldn't fly for the whole time, for the whole year I was here in 99-2000. So I travelled by train exclusively, and just as a way of seeing the US and meeting people, and at the time it was on parity with the cost of flying. But it was just luxury time in terms of just seeing the landscape and this kind of stuff. And everyone has a story to tell on the train. I mean, it's just phenomenal in terms of just finding out. In fact, even this trip, the Bay Area through to Reno, I sat next to a woman who had been in pharmaceutical sales and was interested in getting into software sales and, you know, fascinating series of conversations with just one person. And this is kind of replicated over my travels across the US. So I do thoroughly recommend Amtrak. In fact, I'm a pretty big fan of traveling by train pretty well anywhere.
Well, I like traveling by train in England and in Europe, but I've never had the opportunity really here. But this train goes to Los Angeles, or just hop
just
on.
Just not
on
through Vegas, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, well, this is digressing rapidly. I think the formal formal recording should.
We'll do a model radio podcast, shall we? A model railway podcast.
Yeah, model rail radio, folks. Modelrailradio.com. Anyway, it's been a pleasure, Steve. Please do come back periodically and bring your beta testers and folk who are passionate about it. Because, wonderful to hear from them too. Good talking to you this evening.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
Good night.
Good night.